It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good Monday morning, everyone. If you've been listening to the station over the last couple of days, you know that many people today are acknowledging the 50th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers, which lifted the veil on U.S. government secrets about the Vietnam War and helped lead to the resignation of Richard Nixon, right? There are multiple segments on the station yesterday and today about that history. But we've got a fresh one for you. Not a new set of Pentagon Papers. It's not about the military. Instead, it's an article called The Secret IRS Files, Trove of Never-Before-Seen Records Reveal How the Wealthiest Avoid Income Taxes. Now, maybe you've heard a little about this already. Three ProPublica reporters analyzed over 15 years of tax returns from the richest Americans like Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Elon Musk, and many more. But in addition to just income and taxes, these records showed investments, audits, and debts. What did they find out? Well, the obtained records showed that American business moguls who have managed to exponentially grow their wealth throughout the years pay little and even in some cases, zero income taxes. Now, that may sound like something you already knew or at least suspected, but one interesting thing about the report is it alleges that the ultra-wealthy are able to avoid paying taxes most years legally and without even any need for offshore accounts or secret holdings. So what does this say about our tax code and the unequal treatment built into it, or should we all really just be taking notes so we can do this ourselves? Just kidding. And what does it say about the rest of us? Are we paying a high percentage of our income in taxes, a higher percentage than some of the world's richest people? And is that fair? Are we the 99.9% subsidizing the means for these ultra-wealthy Americans to live extravagant lives? Does our government need to do a serious reexamination of our tax code itself? Joining us now, Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica. Hi, Jesse. Welcome back to WNYC. Thank you for doing this with us.
Hey, Brian. Happy to be back.
And listeners, we'll open up the phones right away. Did you catch the ProPublica report already? What were your thoughts and reactions? Maybe we have some CPAs or tax lawyers listening. Should the Biden administration readdress the current U.S. tax code? What would you suggest they change to address inequality within the system at this level? 646-435-7280. Maybe you've been thinking about this just recently with the late tax filing deadline this year of May 15th, so just a few weeks in the rearview mirror. 646-435-7280 with stories or questions. So, Jesse, you want, you and your co-authors compare how much the ultra-wealthy pay in taxes, comparing that to their gain in wealth. So why do you use that measure instead of just simply looking at income and tax rates?
Right. It's a good question. So the conventional way to do this would be to measure taxes compared to income. And in fact, we do this in a companion piece. And we show that billionaires have a much lower effective tax rate in the conventional way than wealthy people or even someone, a single person making $45,000 a year. That in itself is a blockbuster finding and very interesting. But we thought that it was much more interesting that, in fact, the data demonstrate that the ultra wealthy are outside of the tax system almost entirely. That we have a system where people make money and they get salaries and the taxes get extracted from their salaries, and the wealthy don't. Their income is essentially optional. It's voluntary. They decide when to take it and how much to take, and then they reduce the taxes on that small amount of income. But they're really outside of the system, and so we thought that the better measure was taxes compared to their wealth growth.
Their income is optional, you said. They decide what to take of the money that they're actually taking or not for tax purposes. And the strategy that some of these ultra wealthy folks use is framed in your piece as buy, borrow, and die. Can you break down each one of those?
Yeah, sure. Happy to. It's weird. It's hard to get your mind around it if you're a normal human being, as I say, who's in the tax system and has to work to live, as I do, as you do, as most listeners do. So buy, borrow, die is the way that some super wealthy approach their wealth and their how they live. And what it is that you buy or build or inherit your assets. So you're either Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos, or you're somebody like, I don't know, Jamie Dimon, who hasn't built J.P. Morgan but inherits the position and comes in, or you literally inherit like the Waltons or the Mars family, and you've got a great fortune. Then what you do, instead of selling your stock or selling your assets and getting money from that sale, you can borrow against the assets. And why would you borrow against the assets? Well, if you sell, you have to pay some capital gains tax. Or if you got the equivalent amount in salary, you'd have to pay a top marginal rate of 37% today. Instead, you're borrowing at single-digit rates, so it's a much better deal for you. Plus, you get to hold on to your company this whole time, hold on to control, and you can keep rolling and rolling and rolling over the debt for a very long time. You defer any sale, and you increase the your wealth, and it compounds, especially if the company is growing like Amazon or Tesla. And then by the end of your life, there are a bunch of advantages that you can take to avoid or reduce estate taxes. Estate tax is the last kind of licks that the U.S. government has on you, and you're supposed to be taxed at 40%. But in fact, tax avoidance strategies for the estate tax after death and even right before death are myriad and available for the ultra wealthy. And so they're really not touched in substantial ways by the estate tax. And so you can get through having an enormous fortune that basically never is taxed.
According to the article, no one among the 25 wealthiest avoided as much tax as Warren Buffett, the grandfatherly centibillionaire. Now, that's a word many people have never heard before. What's a centibillionaire?
Yeah, it's a word that we haven't had much in society because we haven't had these kind of fortunes before. But that's somebody who's worth over $100 million. $100 billion with a B, dollars. I actually was someone corrected my grammar there that I should have said hecto-billionaire, that we use the Greek for 100 in that situation. But I like the sound of centibillionaire. But the point with Buffett is that no one takes as little income relative to his wealth and his wealth growth as Warren Buffett. And so he takes very, very little income and then is taxed relatively low rates on that very small income. It's enormous income for you and me, but it's relatively small for a person of his means and wealth. And so he has talked rather famously about having a low tax rate compared to the average person, compared to his secretary. And in fact, when he talks about that, he's talking about his income tax rates, and the income tax rates, both capital gains rates and salary rates, you know, the top marginal rate, are basically irrelevant for him. He's talking about something that even if those rates were to go up, it would be essentially a rounding error for him. And so what we wanted to bring home is that discussion of tax rates in the current tax structure are almost irrelevant for the ultra, ultra wealthy.
And in the case of Warren Buffett, when you mentioned him and his secretary, it probably reminds a lot of people that, wait, isn't Warren Buffett considered a progressive on these issues because he's out there with things like the Buffett rule and saying it's not fair that I would pay a lower income tax rate than my secretary?
Yes, it's a very complicated picture with Buffett. It's to his credit that he's raised these questions and complaints about our tax system. And one of the things that he points out is that taxes on capital, like when you sell a stock, you get a capital gain, and that's tax, and that has favorable tax status compared to salaries. So those of us who don't have capital gains or are in the salary structure, we're paying higher rates than the people who sell. What we wanted to point out, and my colleagues Paul Keel and Jeff Ernsthausen worked on this story with me, and extraordinary reporters. And what we wanted to point out is somebody like Warren Buffett, you know, he talks about his rates on taxable income, and the taxable income that he has are minuscule compared to his overall wealth. So when you talk about his overall wealth, what he's really doing is he's paying, now compare this to an average person, typical person making $60,000 or $70,000, they're paying $14 of that to the government in federal income taxes. But when you talk about Warren Buffett, compared to his wealth growth, it's a different comparison, but it's effectively what his income is, his wealth growth. For the ultra wealthy, wealth growth is like income. He's paying 10 cents for every $100. So $14 to $100, and Buffett has 10 cents for $100.
I think we have a CPA calling in, so let's take his call first. David, you're on WNYC with Jesse Eisinger from ProPublica. Hi, David.
Hey, Jesse. Hey, everyone. I just wanted to provide one snippet of information. You know, the reporting is fantastic, but it is only one page of a book in terms of their overall life and tax strategy. So, you know, it worries me, the narrative of the conversation, just looking at 1 year when there's a lot more that may go on. And Jesse's also making fantastic points. I think touching the recognition of income and wealth is wrought with a lot of difficulty, but that capture on death and estate tax is really what needs to be addressed, because, you know, I don't believe, you know, billionaire may create wealth, but as children and offspring, do they really create wealth? And, you know, what are the rights around somebody inheriting without having, you know, moving dirt and doing work on that?
David, thank you. All right, let's take the estate tax piece of this. You want to give us a little deeper dive, Jesse?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's absolutely right that the estate tax is a big part of it. What we wanted to show was that these great fortunes can compound and grow extraordinary amounts in life itself, and that current tax reform discussions of taxing the wealthy don't touch people in life. But the estate tax is avoided in a few ways. The basic structure is that, well, there are two things that are going on. One is that if you have capital gains, the moment you die, those are ignored for the purposes of taxes. So if you have a stock and you bought it at $10 and it goes up to $110, you've got $110 of gain. $100 of gain.
Untaxed.
And if you sold that today,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, $100 a gain, and that gets taxed at $20. $20 gets taken out. Then if you die tomorrow and you give that to your children, they pay zero capital gains tax on that. They get it at $110, and the gain is wiped out, and taxpayers lose out on that tax. So that's one thing. That's called the step-up in basis. And then the second thing is that you have an estate tax, and the estate should be taxed on that, but there are lots and lots of ways to reduce that. Charitable giving, you wipe out your debt. So all that borrowing that we talked about before, borrowing to fund your lifestyle and borrowing to fund your business, that actually helps you in the estate tax because it takes away from the amount that's left over to get taxed. And then there are arcane sorts of complicated trusts that you can put money into to avoid gift and estate tax. Somebody like Sheldon Adelson, the late casino magnate, he put in billions and billions of dollars into these trusts. They're sort of like loopholes, but they're legal loopholes, aggressive, that are ways to avoid the estate tax. So it is evaded. The issue is that we don't really know how much is evaded from the or avoided from the estate tax because there's so little data on it. The IRS has very little data on it. Scholars have struggled to estimate it. And so that's really one of the black holes of the entire tax world.
The part of that that you just said that was new to me, and so it might be new to a lot of people, is even though we know this estate tax debate goes on in politics all the time, and you know the one side, mostly represented by Republicans, says, wait, I have this money, and I die, I can't just leave my money to my kids without the government taking a bite out of it. I already paid whatever taxes I legally owed, presumably, during the course of my lifetime. So why can't I just pass my money to my kids or whoever when I die? That's the one side of the argument. The other side of the argument is it's new income for the kids or whoever else the heirs are, then they should be taxed on it as new income. That's the usual debate. What you just revealed is that capital gains, which you're not taxed on until you take them out, take those gains out of the stock, for example, not taxed during your lifetime, then they never get taxed because they get passed on to your heirs under the estate tax laws without the tax being taken out. Did I understand you about that? Because that's really
that's
dramatic.
Exactly right. That's exactly right. And actually, the Biden administration has proposed closing this. It's called Step Up in Basis or Stepped Up Basis. And it's widely regarded as a flaw and an unintended consequence of the tax code. It's about 100 years old, and it was a law designed for a different solution and different regime, and not anticipated to be used this way. So there are a lot of critics of this, but it is a cherished giant loophole that is very, very valuable for a select few people. And so you can imagine that there's going to be an extraordinary fight if the Biden administration presses forward with trying to actually get it rescinded.
And even if the heirs, after having inherited those stocks, let's say with capital gains, if they then take the capital gains to spend that money, they're not taxed on it because it passed tax-free in that respect?
So if they sold it right there in my example at $110, they wouldn't have any gain on it because it transferred to them at $110. But if it went up to $115, they would have to pay capital gains on the new $5 of gain. So, but what they do is it gets to be counted as if they bought it at the new level, the existing level, and everything else, all the past, all the history is wiped out.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica. Their groundbreaking investigation released in the last few days, the secret IRS files, trove of never-before-seen records, reveal how the wealthiest avoid income taxes. Eric in Red Bank, you're on WNYC with Jesse Eisinger. Hi, Eric.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning, Jesse. Thanks so much for doing this reporting. I was fascinated to read at least part one of it last week. I was hoping you could clarify something and see if I've got it right, and it has to do with that revolving line of credit that a lot of the ultra-wealthy use to fund their lifestyle. So if they don't want to draw a salary and pay taxes on that, if they don't want to sell assets and pay capital gains on that, they can just get a line of credit from a creditor. My question is, how then does that credit ever come due? And when it does come due, do they then have to sell an asset or draw a salary and then pay that tax amount in order to pay back the creditor? Or, and I think this is what you were saying before, do they simply continue to roll it over, roll it over, roll it over, and when they die, it becomes like a loss, and then it actually offsets any tax liability they would have after death? Is that right? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, it's a good question. So you know, there's a variety of techniques. So there's not just one technique, and not all ultra wealthy people borrow, and not all ultra wealthy people borrow in the same way. You can borrow both to fund your lifestyle. Larry Ellison has disclosed that he's had a $10 billion credit line at one point. And of course, he's had many houses and mansions, and he's got a giant estate that's designed like a Japanese feudal medieval village, and he has an entire Hawaiian island. And then Jeff Bezos is building a $500 million yacht. And then there are other people like Carl Icahn, who borrows, and it's actually part of his business, and it amplifies his investing returns. So we're essentially, and then he writes off the interest costs on his taxes. And so we're essentially, taxpayers are supplementing his speculation and his improved returns. The question is, then, what happens to the borrowing? And many times you can keep rolling it over, paying minor small parts of interest, sometimes not even interest at all. The interest gets rolled into the amount, and then often it gets settled up at death, after death, in the estate. So there's really often no paying back, but sometimes you can pay it back. And if you paid it back late in life or after a few years, you've gotten the benefit of all that deferred accumulation of wealth, all that kind of compounding that's worked for you. So it's enormously advantageous, even if you pay it back over, you know, after a few years.
Jesse, people must be reading your secret IRS files article, because our phones are jammed. So we'll continue in a minute with more callers. And a question from Twitter. Somebody wrote, regarding a ProPublica study, how does the U.S. tax code compare to other countries? Are we an anomaly? We'll answer that and more when we continue. Brian Lehrer on continue with Jesse Eisinger from ProPublica on their series, The Secret IRS Files. Trove of never-before-seen records reveal how the wealthiest avoid income taxes. And I mentioned that tweet, Jesse, that came in. Listener David writes, regarding the ProPublica study, how does the U.S. tax code compare to other countries? Are we an anomaly? And I think a caller, Monty in Yorkville, wants to elaborate on that question. Monty, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling in.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to your guest. What I want to say that all the country has the same issue. No country I know, at least part of the OECD, that taxes unrealized profit. So there is absolutely no solution. The only thing that the U.S. government can do, which other do, all of them do, is tax long-term and short-term profit at the same rate. That means that give little incentive for someone to leave their profit going on and on and on forever, because one day they're going to have a really stiff bill, you know.
Monty, thank you very much. I think we're not ready to accept his conclusion that there is no solution, but how would you compare the U.S. to other countries in these respects, Jesse?
Well, it's funny. There is a country, a well-developed Western country, and most people in the country who have wealth are, and it's illiquid wealth, so can't really trade it very easily, and it's hard to assess from a day-to-day basis what it is, and it's taxed. And this is the form of wealth that most people in this country have, and it's taxed. The country that I'm talking about is called the United States, and what I'm talking about is property taxes. So, in fact, the vast majority of Americans have, if they have wealth at all, they have wealth in their homes, and their homes actually are taxed on an annual basis at the local level. And these are, as I say, illiquid assets and hard-to-value assets, but they're assessed. So the existence of wealth tax basically exists in this country. Now, the other thing I would say is that there are wealth taxes in other countries. Wealth taxes have not been particularly successful for a wide variety of reasons. France abandoned one relatively recently. Switzerland actually has a wealth tax, and it works pretty well. It's pretty modest, and they don't have capital gains taxes. There aren't tax regimes that focus on solely on unrealized gains. But, you know, the United States has a lot of influence, a lot of power, and it could do these things. It's not like taxing unrealized gains was prohibited by the Constitution. It was not sent down, written in stone from Mount Sinai. It's only about 100 years old, our tax regime, and there's nothing fixed about it.
And it's interesting that you bring up property taxes, which, of course, are local, not federal. I have said before that if I could propose one progressive amendment to the United States Constitution, it might be that no state shall use property taxes as the determination of education funding, because we see the inequality in that all over the place. If you're wealthy and you live in a wealthy neighborhood and therefore you can contribute a lot in property taxes without dinging your lifestyle too much, then your local school system is flush. If you're a lower income person living among other lower income people and school funding is based on property taxes, which it is in so many places around the country, then there's that inequality in education funding. And then, yes, states do different things to try to compensate for it and all of that, but it starts with this fundamental inequality almost everywhere. And property taxes are outside the federal system, so they don't get the kind of scrutiny, even though everybody in local elections, like in New Jersey, for example, are always complaining about property taxes, but not much ever seems to get done.
Yeah, I agree that there are a lot of inherent flaws in the existing property tax system, and you could allocate money for education in a much different way, or solve for desegregation and inequities in the education system in some other way.
Right.
But I was just making one point about property taxes, which is that they're the equivalent of a wealth tax for the average person, while the ultra wealthy do not have either really effective income taxes or any wealth tax to speak of.
Exactly. And if you're not going to fund education, to my point, with property taxes primarily, then you need to have more of an income tax base in each state in order to do that with sufficient funding. And then you get back to the influence of wealthier people who try to keep their income tax rates down, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down that rabbit hole. Brad in Gramercy Park, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brad.
Hi, guys. I think the biggest flaw in the tax system right now is the fact that when there are six tax brackets between $1 when it comes to couples and $629,000, above $629,000, there's one tax bracket of 37%, whether you make $1 million, $100 million, or $1 billion. Why don't people speak more about more tax brackets above the 37% bracket of $629,000 on a married couple?
Do you know the answer to that one, Jesse?
Well, we were trying to point out with our story is that discussion of tax brackets, which really dominates our political conversation, and you almost hear that to the exclusion of everything else. Biden is proposing an increase of the top marginal tax rate from 37% to 39.6%. Sometimes people talk about capital gains rates as well. What we were trying to say is that because these people are outside of the tax system, the ultra wealthy are outside of the tax system so completely that top marginal tax rates are basically irrelevant for them. Jeff Bezos earns a $80,000 middle class salary as the CEO of Amazon. The Larry Page and Sergey
Brin. Really, $80,000? That's his official salary. What a sham.
Yeah, exactly. And, I'm sure you've heard of CEOs taking a $1 salary, Steve Jobs, Larry Page, Mark Zuckerberg, Sergey Brin. They sort of ostentatiously do that. this isn't the kind of self-sacrifice that it sort of seems, or, you know, kind of shared sort of solidarity with their workers. It's because salaries are taxed at the highest marginal rates for those guys, because they'd be making so much money. And so they avoid that tax by getting very little in salary. So, you know, you could reform the system. There are people who make $1 million, you know, the top 0.01% starts at about $70 million. You could tax that more. There are people who have high income, and some hedge fund managers, and Michael Bloomberg, those guys have, Michael Bloomberg makes $1 billion, $2 billion a year. So, but they have other tax avoidance, tax minimization strategies to play with, so that you don't need to pity them for having to pay a lot of taxes. But the top marginal tax rate is not particularly relevant for the ultra wealthy.
And I'm so glad you pointed that out, and you brought that up twice now in this conversation, because it is so much of what we hear in the news coverage of the tax debate in Washington. It's, should the top rate be 37%? Should it be 31%? Similar with the corporate income tax. And yet it misses these gigantic loopholes that aren't even in that system. One example from your article, I'll just read from your article, and people may have their eyes bug out at this one. In 2011, a year in which his wealth held roughly steady at $18 billion, Jeff Bezos filed a tax return reporting that he lost money. His income that year was more than offset by investment losses. What's more, because according to the tax law, he made so little. He even claimed and received a $4,000 tax credit for his children. Wow.
Every little bit helps, Brian.
Dean in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dean.
Yes, thank you, Brian, for a wonderful program. I listen to you every day. I just have a pretty general question. In reading the Times article that somebody who made $25,000 could be taxed, could be audited, and that was more likely than the wealthy would be audited. I guess they're very underfunded. But I wonder if your guest has any solution at all, any path to correcting this when people really get a sense of what, how much injustice is in play here.
Dean, thank you very much. And on that question of who gets audited, I mean, this whole investigation of yours, Jesse, at ProPublica that we're talking about, I know grew out of your previous investigation that was called Gutting the IRS, right?
Yes, exactly. And in fact, that was our article, Paul Keel and my article, about how you were more likely to be audited if you were a working poor person in America than you were making $400,000 or $500,000 a year. And that's because we audit in this country people getting the earned income tax credit at higher rates than we do the affluent. The ultra wealthy are still audited a little bit higher, but those rates have been collapsing, and we've been stripping the IRS of budget for about a decade now, and tens of thousands of employees have left, and auditors, we have fewer auditors now. Actually, the actual amount of auditors are fewer than they were at any time since the 1950s, when the economy was, you know, a seventh of the size it is today. That is an extraordinary problem, is that we don't have tax police on the job anymore. The Biden administration has proposed a substantial increase for the IRS and an increase for the kinds of things that they would need to do, you know, the kind of specialty jobs that they would need to have to audit the super wealthy, because the super wealthy have much, much more complicated taxes than the rest of us. This is a reclamation project that can't be done in a year, can't be done in 2 years, and can't be done with a modest amount of money. It's, you know, tens of billions of dollars, I think, and it would take many, many years. And we'll see if that also can get passed. People don't want to give the IRS more power, especially Republicans.
So what are the main policy solutions to make sure that the wealthiest of the wealthy do actually get taxed on what is income, even though it doesn't count under the income tax code?
Well, there aren't really solutions in the code today because, as we are at pains to explain the story, this is all entirely legal. They're outside of the system in an entirely legal and routine way. So you'd have to pass new laws or have a completely new approach to taxation. As for avoidance techniques that are aggressive or evasion, you could ramp up both criminal enforcement and civil enforcement at the IRS. And you'd need specialists, you'd need a huge recruiting effort, you'd need huge training, you'd need much more resources and budget to the IRS over years to do this and increase the audit rates. And you could, there is a giant tax gap, which is, when we talk about the tax gap, we're not talking about legal avoidance, we're talking about illegal avoidance, like people who owe lots and lots of money, over $1 million to the IRS, but haven't filed their taxes. That turns out not to be legal. You're supposed to file your taxes. You might have occurred to you. But so you could close that. You could attempt to close that and gain. And that's running roughly $600 billion to $1 trillion a year. So that could bring in a ton of money, although it would also take a lot of effort. Funding the IRS actually pays for itself. It's one of the few things that really is an extraordinary return on investment. And so it should be a no-brainer, but of course nothing in Washington is.
Right. And just to get back to the legal side for a minute, because I think that really is the bigger story. If there were one or two policies that could start taxing income that goes under the radar legally, what might they be?
Well, you know, we're not policy advocates. We're just journalists. But there are
proposals. Your sources tell you.
Well, Ron Wyden, the senator from Oregon, has a proposal to tax unrealized gains. And what that would be is a carefully designed policy there where you're essentially paying tax over the course of 10 years. And so if the gain disappears, one of the frequent arguments is this isn't real wealth. It fluctuates.
Right. The stock could go down tomorrow. Yeah.
Of course, the stock could go down tomorrow. And if it went down tomorrow, Jeff Bezos would still be worth, you know, $170 billion instead of $180 billion. So the wealth is a relatively permanent sort of fixture at that level, at that nosebleed level. But yes, you could design a unrealized gain tax where it unfolds over the course of 10 years. And if you still have the gain, you still owe the money. So that's one solution. And then the other solution is the IRS measures your wealth. This is what Warren and Sanders, the two senators who ran for president, proposed, where you have a wealth tax. And that's got some challenges, but it's easier these days because one of the things that we have today is a very effective and intensive banking system. And the banks estimate people's wealth all the time for the purposes of lending to them. So they're not just measuring publicly traded wealth like Bezos and Tesla's, Musk. Those guys have wealth that's relatively easy to measure because it's largely in publicly traded stock. Mm-hmm. But the Bloombergs of the world, the Kochs of the world, they have private empires, and those are harder to value. But there are lots and lots of banks, investment bankers and commercial bankers that understand the value of those assets very, very well. And you can actually value it pretty easily. It's not that complex. And if those third parties reported to the IRS, a wealth tax would be much harder to evade or avoid. And one of the regimes that we have, the reason why the vast majority of Americans pay their taxes is that it's extracted from a third party. It's extracted through the paychecks. And so there's well over 90% compliance for average people because we have no choice in the matter. Our taxes are already out before we see a dollar in take-home pay. But for the ultra-wealthy, they get taxed in a completely different way, often through complex partnerships and things like that. And so the compliance rates are really 50 cents on the dollar.
Well, wealth inequality, in addition to income inequality, one of the defining issues of our age and helping us to understand a piece of it. Jesse Eisinger, senior reporter and editor at ProPublica, with two of his colleagues. He wrote the article, "The Secret IRS Files, Trove of Never-Before-Seen Records Reveal How the Wealthiest Avoid Income Taxes." Jesse, thanks so much, and I look forward to the rest of the project.
Thank you for having me.